The Daily Mirror calls on you.
Ah, it's absolute bollocks, that. That's fucking nonsense.
I am going to get 100% out of you.
We are not just what you call underdogs, but massive underdogs.
Welcome to another Mirror Football podcast. My name is Steve Anglesey. Joining me later on, a radio legend, Mike Porky Parry, ex of TalkSport. But first, and the bigger radio legend, the elderly Ed Travolta, come in, Robbie Savage.
Hello, Steve. You got Mike Porky Parry on. Very interesting.
It's an interesting choice of guests today, isn't it?
Very interesting. We've done a five live show together.
It went well, didn't it?
If you called me Robbie Fowler twice, and
obviously saying welcome to TalkSport, which was good as well, wasn't
it? He has Twitter ramblings at me now and again, which I find bizarre.
He does have a Twitter ramble at you, doesn't he? But let's talk about Strictly Come Dancing first. Obviously, this will be going out on Thursday night. You're back on Saturday night.
Yes.
What's the dance this week?
Well, the dance this week, Stephen, is the tango. And to be fair, I think this should be my best dance because every single week on it, I look like I've been tangled. The spray tan. So,
Are you going for double spray tan now? Is it two sessions?
Hey, I am going for the darkest spray tan possible, and the teeth are going whiter. The eyes are. When you get the spray tan so dark, your eyes look incredibly blue. To be fair, to me, I love it, mate. I love it. I love it.
And what does the good lady wife think about all of this?
Yeah, she's fine, miss. She's fine. She cut the first one. We took them to her. She come on with the first one. Then last week was my brother. This week is he's like my brother really. It's a cousin Matt, you know, the army guy.
Yeah, absolutely.
So it's him and Debbie this week. So I'm spending around the family just. For every week to go, though, man, I need to get to the final. Which is impossible, really. Well, not impossible, but. After last week, mate, getting a 7th off Craig was unbelievable, really. Mate, last week was one of the best nights of my life. You were away, were you?
It was us. I've seen it, though. No, I saw it, yes. It was very, very... You were very, very good, I thought.
Yeah,
very
just good. I picked that. It's just middle of the first week, honestly. I was atrocious, and I've improved, yes. So just hope I can improve again.
Well, let's hope so. I mean, it's not the main event of the weekend. The main event of the weekend is obviously... Liverpool v Man United, and everyone is going to be talking before the game about Wayne Rooney. I don't know, when something happens to you, happens to a member of your family like it did with Wayne Rooney before the England game, is it impossible to put that out of your mind when you're playing? Because is that why you kicked out?
For me, I was, as soon as you cross the white line, I think you just go into a zone where you don't think about it. I think the best place to be is when something like that happens, is be on the pitch. I think that's the safe place, so I mean, that's where you are in your comfort zone. But for me personally, I don't know what Wayne would think, but for me personally, when you step over that white line, you know, you could have troubles in your life. You know, I did my father, Alzheimer's, and, you know, but when you cross that white line, man, there's nothing else matters in the world. So I don't believe in it, you know, me personally, it's just me. Everybody's different, let's not forget that, but for me, my safe place was on the football field, whatever was going on in my life.
So, I mean, what about Rooney at Anfield then? I mean, you were known as somebody who would wind up the opposition. Will people be winding him up? Would you, if you were still playing in that game, would you have had a sneaky word with him, you know, about something that's happened to him?
He's one of the best players in the world. No question about that. So you've got to wind him up. Draw the crowd up. But I think he's got to realise now, you know, you can't be petulant again and do stuff. I know that it was Fling when he done it, but, you know, I just think that you can't keep doing, you know, things. He's got to... The way he's had this season, Steve, honestly, I believe he's behind Messi, probably the second best player in the world.
Yeah.
It's a strong statement. David Silva, you could say, arguably. You know, but the way Rooney started this season, wow, he's been on fire. So, I believe, yeah, of course you try and wind him up, but... I fancy Liverpool 20, but honestly, I do.
Do you really?
Yeah, I just think they will. I just think, I've made a statement before the start of the season, United could go and beat all season. I think they're going to slip up. You know, it's going to be here. I just think Liverpool at Anfield, you know, I'm just thinking they might nick it.
I mean, very up and down, aren't they, Liverpool? But just on the, I mean, on the Rooney thing, what advice would you give him then to sort of, how do you block that out and use it to your advantage when there's a really hostile crowd on your back, when well, other
Wayne
people
Rooney.
Are saying things?
That's all you've got to think. I'm Wayne yeah. Rooney. Do you know what I mean? Jealousy, there's loads of people jealous of him, obviously. You know, he's one of the best players in the world. Just walking now, he is Wayne Rooney. I mean, what more would you want? You've got all the ability in the world. Do you know what I mean? It's, if people wind him up, they're doing it because he is one of the best players in the world. They wound me up because I was basically crap. But he is one of the best players in the world. So just, if I was Wayne Rooney, I'd be thriving on it.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I don't think he's really ever had a really great game at Anfield either, but Manchester United have had a lot of success at Anfield.
Yeah.
What's it like to play against Wayne Rooney? You've played against him a few times.
Well, I don't think, if he plays exceptionally well, I don't think you can stop him, he's that good. But, you know, I played against him numerous times, and for Blackburn we had a little scuffle on the halfway line in the semi-final of the Cup. You know, but you can't stop him. If he plays to his potential, you can't stop him, he's that good, I believe. You know, so do you man-to-man mark him? No, I just think you've got to try and wind him up.
Yeah, and when you give him a little dig, I mean, he's so big, isn't he, that he just bounces off him.
He gives you one back. If I'm Wayne Rooney, I don't change anything about myself. Just learn a little bit, maybe kicking out on the petulance. But, you know, the way he plays the game, his aggression, you know, I wouldn't change at all if I was him.
You say Liverpool have got a chance in this game and you think they're going to win. How are they going to win? What are the weaknesses
for
that
me,
they can...
I know Andy Carroll scored against Everton in the derby, but for me, I'd play the movement of United because... I'd play me personally, Bellamy, Suarez, Kite, Downing, with them four buzzing about each other. Gerrard to come back in the fold with Adam. You look at that and thinking, wow, that front six really, you know, because they're all attacking players. You know, would Gerrard have to curb his runs? I don't think so because Charlie Adam will sit there and spray the ball about. Mm. So I think Liverpool have got a chance. Or do you go the other way? Play Andy Carroll up against. You know, is Ferdinand Vidic injured? If that's the case, do they go up against Johnny Evans or Phil Jones? Do you know what I mean? So it's an intriguing thing, but I'd go for the pace and the movement of Bellamy and Suarez. I would.
Nobody's been sacked in the Premier League so far. We're six, seven games in, aren't we? Seven or eight games in.
Yeah.
If Blackburn get beat by QPR at the weekend, is Steve Keane going to go?
I think the two
is Steve Bruce going to go? Yeah.
I'm sure. I know Steve Bruce, and I know Bruce. You'll get right. You can't get all them 12 players or many players they bought, you know, and then get sacked after or leave after 8-9 games. Them players need at least 6 months to gel. They do, and Bruce, he will get them right because his man manager's skills are fantastic. He's a great guy. And for me, he's got a great coaching head at Black with him. You know, Brucey will get it right. It's just them, the Macam, you know, there's 40,000 turn up and they want to see their team winning, like every team does. But I know because the way Brucey is, you know, he's if you're doing well, he puts his arm around you. If you're doing poor, he still puts his arm around you. He'll give you, you know, telling off. But, you know, he still cares for you. And every play does that for. And for me, he was great. So I'm sure Brucey will get it right. But, you know, the way Premier League football is, sometimes Sherman can win. If he has a couple of bad results, he's under huge, huge pressure. Steve Keane, I think he's a different kettle of fish. I think you know, he's inexperienced. You know, Blackburn have had a poor start. I believe they're a poor team. And I said at the start of the season, I think they'll go down. I think they'll go down whoever's in charge. If they get a new manager, I still believe it because I don't believe the players are good enough. Junior Hoyler, I believe, is a sensation. He's a fantastic player. But I think, irrespective of the win against Arsenal, you know, Steve Keane under massive, massive pressure. I still feel sorry for him in a way.
Why?
Well, because has he been given a chance really by, you know, the fan? Steve Keane, it's not really the biggest name, and he's not a big name. He's not a big name manager, you know. But then you could say, you know, he was working, you know, under Sam, and you know, you can't blame him for taking the job. You get offered the job. You know, you're going to cause. It's a wonderful opportunity for him. So I don't blame him for taking the job, you know. But you know, what you can't expect him to do then is the fans having a go at him, say, please leave, because it's a wonderful job for him. He might not get another job as a manager. I mean, so why not stick in there and fight it out? You don't blame anybody for taking a job in the Premier League, mate. If you turn it down, wow, you wouldn't do that. But, you know, he's got owners there who are saying they're going to buy people like, when they come in, maybe get people like Ronaldinho and stuff. And, you know, no disrespect, they haven't bought real Eddie Markey signs in my eyes. So,
no.
You just wonder what's happening at football club. But I think that Steve Keane, you know, could be the first to go.
Should he not be allowed to go? Should there be a transfer window for sacking managers?
Steve, I said on 606, I believe in a transfer window for managers.
Right. When would it start though? Would it be the same as this transfer window?
Same as the players.
Yeah, yeah. So the first time you could sack a manager would be January.
See, I'd have at least a year, but you know, I could, you know, at least 6 months. You know, January and the summer. You know, because if you appointed, you know, things like going after 10 games, do you know what I mean? I think it's down to the chairman as much as you that, you know, their appointment, if you get sacked after 10 games, it's nonsense. You need at least 6 months. So for me, I'd bring a transfer window in for managers, no question.
Yeah. That's it. All right. Thank you very much, Robbie Savage. Don't forget, keep dancing.
Cheers, mate.
Thanks to Robbie Savage there. Our next guest today is a legend in his own long lunchtime. He's a former Fleet Street hack, former FA press officer, former TalkSport programme director and presenter, and now he's the host of Sport Tonight Live TV. Welcome to the legend that is Mike Porky Parry.
Welcome, guys. Thanks very much indeed for inviting me in. I tell you what, by the way, you boys have got the technology.
It's luxurious in here, isn't it? Now, obviously, Mike, most of our listeners are going to know you best from your time on TalkSport.
Sure.
You were instrumental in turning that around after the disastrous launch of Talk Radio. Then you had a brilliant breakfast show with Alan Brazil, which I know a lot of people listen to. Then you had a mid-morning show, and then suddenly now you're gone.
Yeah.
Your mate Andy Gray is in with Richard Keith.
Yeah.
What went on there?
Well, nothing went on. I'd done 10 years there, right? And I'd eventually arrived in the mid-morning show with Mike Graham, MG, or Fatso, as he's known to me. And we had a great partnership, no doubt about it. But I'll be perfectly honest, I knew now that I'm getting to the stage in my career where I've got one more job left in me. And I didn't honestly want to spend the next 7 or 8 years doing the same job after doing it for 10 years. And look, Sport, you know, TalkSport are brilliant. And I take great pride in having shaped their image and shaped their sound. I loved it and all that. But there were other things I wanted to do. And you can't do two things at once. You've got to give total commitment. And in the end, you know, I asked for a variation on the contract. It wasn't forthcoming. So I decided to go. I go wishing them the very best. Andy Gray is a mate of mine. He's also a hero because he was an Everton centre forward. I want him to do extremely well. I don't know Richard that well, but I hope they make it. And on the day I left, I spoke to Scott Taunton there, the guy who runs it, chief executive. And I said, look, when you're up to 5 million figures, Scott, I'll be at the front of the queue applauding you. I wish you all the very best. I've decided to go into TV. I've got a new TV concept. It's called Sports Tonight Live. We've started on the internet, but this weekend, I can reveal exclusively, we're moving on to the Freeview box.
Oh, excellent.
And after that, we don't know how ambitious we'll be for our platforms after that, but we're building.
So Sport Tonight TV is you talking about sport with no rights, nothing like that?
No, we ain't got any rights, therefore you've got to base it on personality. So I've got to have in the studio with me a lot of people who like a bit of banter, and the banter's all important, you know, to get around that. And we're talking to ex-footballers. Ex-footballers, are, you know, and you get an intelligent ex-footballer, they're great. As you know, I worked with Brazil, I worked with Andy Townsend in the past. I'm going to work with some
intelligent ex-footballers.
No, they are. No, they're good lads. Hey, watch it. And it's great. And there's some other great intelligent footballers around, which we'll unearth and give a first opportunity to, you know, on the new station. And also, we've invented what's called the Skype wall. So like on radio, it's all coming in through your ears and it's telephones and all that. Now we've got a massive great screen, so we've got one presenter on the right, one on the left, in the middle, a massive great screen, and that's where the face of the third person in the show comes in. Skyping, you see what I mean? Off a laptop.
Yes, absolutely.
Or these days, this is why we felt we were able to go into this sort of technology, you can do it by holding your iPhone in front of your face, or
do it off your iPad on your train. You see what I mean? And it's amazing where we find people who want to talk to us on phones. I mean, like up mountains and all sorts of things. You know,
it sounds good. I mean, would any camera be able to fit the whole head of Alan Brazil onto it?
Well, no. I mean, I'm not sure if you've got a wide screen in a cinema. I live down in on the coast in Portsmouth, and they've got one of them view cinemas, you know.
You can still see his head from there.
You see his head back in London from there. It's like a Alicia Beacon, but whether it would get on the width of the screen or not, I don't know. But hey, Al, you know, come on, pal, we're buddies.
Yes. Now, what was it like working with Alan Brazil of a morning?
It sounded
like a lot of fun.
It was a lot of fun. I mean, it could be stressful at times because I always tried to get in there as early as I could, and the show started at 6, so I was always trying to be there for 4:30 to do some what we call preparation, you know what I mean? Get through the papers, find out what's going on. If Al got there at 6:01, it was a good day. Believe me, it was a good day, because it was usually more likely 6:01, just as we were halfway through the news, you know? But it was all, you know, let's go and get on with it. And Al is such an instinctive broadcaster. He didn't really even need to know what was in the papers. He could pick up on anything, you know, very knowledgeable.
Yeah.
You know, a very bright guy. It was a lot of fun. And I think it was that raw sort of instinct which got us through the shows that appealed to people.
I think, his intelligence and his ability to turn something round in that way is really lost because he portrays himself as a great Falstaffian character. Yeah. But he is actually very sharp. Obviously, there are moments when it didn't go so well, the Bob Monkhouse incident, of course.
Well, yeah, sure. But, well, I mean, we got some classic footage we'd never went out of Al trying to introduce him. Come on, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to... You know, and that kind of stuff. And it's classic footage, you know, which we keep and play at Christmas parties and that sort of stuff. But it doesn't matter, you know. We get a spike at 6:00. They get a spike at 6:00 on TalkSport. People tune in to find out whether Al's had a good night or not. You know, what does he sound like this morning? What time did he get in? How long is he going to stay? You know, but he is a great character and a great broadcaster and a big pal.
And you unfortunately, at one stage, you had to sack him. What was that like?
Well, that was
what happened there?
That was the Cheltenham Gold Cup, and I was also the programme director then, as well as the breakfast show host. And what happened was, we were there on the Thursday, and it was the last day of the meeting, so it was the Gold Cup day. He wanted to stay for it, and I said, I don't think we should. I think we should get back. Anyway, I had to make a decision, and I left after just one pint of Guinness in the Guinness tent after
so
the
you
show.
Weren't doing a show the next morning, obviously.
Not from Cheltenham.
Yes.
We were doing it back in London.
Right. Yes.
And it was a big show because Ken Bates was coming in. He was then chairman of Chelsea. And I said, Al, you've got to get back. Whatever you do, I don't care how you get back or what time you get back, you've got to get back. I said, don't put yourself at risk in a car or anything like that. We'll send a car for you, whatever you want, you know. Anyway, the following morning came. It was a fiasco. Al had stayed overnight, tried to get back. Car ran out of petrol on the Oxford Ring Road or something like that, you know. One of those sort of things that happens. And he never turned up. Anyway, the management had... They took a very specific stand on this and said it can't happen, so I'll have to go. And he pushed off to Switzerland. The interview with Ken Bates, which I had to do on my own because we couldn't find anybody else at short notice, was absolutely classic. And it made the back page of every newspaper, including the Mirror, because Bates was in really feisty fighting form, you know, attacking the people who ran football, attacking his fellow chairman, attacking greedy players and all that kind of stuff. And I would love to have been there for it. But anyway... He pushed off to Switzerland because that's Al. What, you don't want me to know? Okay, not a problem. off skiing and off that, and he went off skiing. And I think I actually delivered the sacking message to him when he's on the top of something like the Matterhorn or something like that, you know. Al, Mike, here, look, mate, I'm sorry. Yeah, all right, boy, I can't talk to you, son. Just open a bottle of Crystal. Talk to you later, bang, you know. And that was it.
And then he was obviously he came back and everything went very well. Now you're looking out from looking back into it from the outside.
Yeah.
Do you think that was it inevitable that TalkSport would go this way? Obviously, you had Brazil. Yeah. There was a lot of Royster Doyster in.
Sure.
There was the whole ethos of the station was like that, and it was a radio station for people who liked a pint, drove a van, etc., etc.
Yeah,
hopefully not at the same time. Was it inevitable that that was going to change and it would become a more serious sports station?
I don't think it ever has become more. If it's become more serious in sport, I haven't been listening to it enough recently. I mean, I know what you mean. A lot of I think a lot of what makes people listen is the unexpected and a bit of banter. Now, I can't speak for the people who run it now, can't speak for the programme director. If they formalise some other shows, perhaps they're right. I mean, they're still getting very good figures. They're a very strong brand. They're a profitable company. So they can't be doing much wrong, frankly. And to that extent, I wish them well.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it's still a great listen. I mean, it's been a very colourful life. You were a press man for many years, as we said. Then it was a bit of poacher term gamekeeper, wasn't it? You went to work for the FA as press officer.
Well, what it was there, I'd been working for The Sun, and I'd been taken on there by Kelvin McKenzie. He left and went to Sky to become a TV mogul himself. And funnily enough, he's involved in a new TV project with me now. But he left, and his successor came in and had a shake-up, which I fully understand, you know, and I wasn't required, which is fine. That's absolutely no problem. I understand that. And funnily enough, just as I was leaving The Sun, David Davis, who was an old mate and a BBC broadcaster up till then in the northwest, where I come from, had rung me up and said, "I'm taking over as head of the press at the FA." I said, "Right." He said, "I haven't got anybody there." He said, "There's nobody in the department. There isn't a department. Do you want to come along?" I said, "Yeah, sure. I'll come along and help you out for a couple of weeks. I've never done it before, but, football, FA, great." I went along, and I was only going to stay 2 or 3 weeks. I stayed for a year, and the reason I stayed for a year was because the stories never stopped coming. The first one was Paul Merson, who, ironically, as we speak, is now subject of allegations about a drink driving setup again. Merson had become an alcoholic, a gambling addict. He'd been stuffing cocaine up his nose, all of which he admitted, right, "Oh, what are we going to do about this?" Bruce Grobbelaar was involved in implications of match fixing. We only had one away game that season because we'd already pre-qualified for Euro 96 as hosts. The one away game was in Ireland. It was a riot. They wrecked the stadium and the game was abandoned, right? George Graham suddenly became the subject of speculation, picking up suitcases full of hundreds of thousands of pounds. And it was the most amazing year that you've ever had in football in your life. Everything that could have happened was happening, even tragic things like in the semi-finals. A fan was killed when a coach backed over the fan. All these kind of things are happening. It's left, right and centre. It was the Cantona year.
Yeah.
One night at the Palace, when he kung fu kicked the fan. You just couldn't believe it. And I thought to myself, all this must have been happening for years, but they never had a press officer. So this is why it's all coming out now. It could well be the situation. Anyway, got to the end of that year and I thought, hang on. I the funny story is that, because I was still a dyed-in-the-wool newspaper man, I was mixing with a lot of the hacks, my old mates, guys from the Express, the Mirror, the Sun. And, of course, I was going out, getting bladdered with them, having another drink, Mike. I was telling them all the inside stories. And the following morning, every morning, early, I was getting summoned to Graham Kelly's office, because Graham Kelly was the chief executive of the FA then, and about the most uncharismatic man you've met in your life, "Well, Mike, another problem this morning." "Oh, what's that, Graham?" "There's a story in the paper here about allegations about Paul Merson. I want you to launch an immediate inquiry into the leak." "Right, okay, Graham, leave that with me. I'll get on that right away." That probably happened about 20 times, I think. I don't think I ever reported back to him with any success about who was the person leaking these stories.
So let's talk about Everton now, because you are a friend of Bill Kenwright's.
Yep.
Does that, do you, when you hear the Blue Union coming out and saying he's got to go, can you put your friendship aside? Can you hear what they're saying?
I can't really put it aside. And I'll tell you why. Because I can only base my evaluation of Bill Kenwright's character on the fact that he is a close personal friend. So I know, for instance, when I went to his 60th birthday party, which was in Les Ambassador in London, he invited me there, invited all his friends there. He was a most generous host. He hardly drinks, by the way, Bill. Hardly. I think I've seen him once try a glass of champagne and that's about it. But take this for instance. The last time we played QPR before they got up to this division was in a League Cup game, and it was down at QPR. Now, whenever I go, he always invites me into the director's box. I don't always accept the invitation because I do like to be with the lads. And I've got my own season ticket at Everton anyway. So, and it is very formal. You wear a tie in director's boxes and all that. But occasionally I do, and I did at QPR that night because he asked me to. And there were four spare seats on the Everton side of the bus. He went outside and he walked into the street where there are a load of Everton fans, and invited four of them back into the director's box and gave them each a tie that he had in his pocket, which he'd brought, down from upstairs. And they came and joined us in the box. That's how much an Evertonian is.
Hmm.
He mortgaged his house to try and buy Everton. His house is mortgaged up to the hill to try and buy Everton. He mortgaged his business. He's got the world's biggest theatre impresario agency. He's got about, I think, 40 productions on around the world in places like Australia and Buenos Aires and Broadway. The truth of the matter is, Bill Kenwright is not anywhere near wealthy enough to fund a club on his own. Yeah. You have to be of a minimum billionaire status these days. But I do believe that if he didn't give 50% of his time completely unpaid to Everton Football Club, he would be a billionaire. He is so successful in the world of theatre, he'd be a Cameron Mackintosh, he'd be an Andrew Lloyd Webber. But he does spend 50% of his time on looking after Everton Football Club. During transfer windows, he doesn't spend 1 minute of his time on his theatre business. And the other thing is, I read the other day that Mr... I can never pronounce his name, the chap who runs Arsenal, Mr. Gazidis.
Gazidis, yes.
According to reports I read, took £1.7 million out of the club last year. Fine. It's a big club. It's run very efficiently. I'm sure he's worth every penny. Bill Kenwright's worth that and more, and he doesn't take a penny. He doesn't even take his petrol to go to away matches. And for that reason, I feel that the fans who give him a very hard time don't quite understand that there are no solutions. Bill hasn't put any money in his pocket, neither has anybody else on the board of directors. We are merely trying to stop ourselves from becoming a Portsmouth. Mm. I live down on the coast, as I said earlier in this interview. Every time I see a yacht coming over the horizon from the direction of the Isle of Wight, it's another sheikh or some guy from Russia coming to buy Portsmouth. And 6 weeks later, the same thing happens all over again. You know what I mean? And we don't want to be there. We don't want to be a Leeds United. We don't want to even be a Nottingham Forest. We want to be Everton. We want to stay where we are.
Yeah.
That's my view. I do respect the Blue Union. I do want money pumped into Everton. But I know how hard Bill's been looking for an investor, and we simply can't find one.
Yeah, he's actively trying to sell the club, isn't he?
Listen, for the last 7 years, I've gone to the AGM. I always take the day off and go up to Liverpool and get in there and watch every word so that later, when I'm challenged, I can say, no, you didn't go to the AGM. I'm a shareholder at Everton. I did, you know. And every year he starts something by saying the search goes on for a new investor, a new owner. He would sell tomorrow. And if you've ever seen him after 6 weeks of a transfer window, he looked physically ill, you know, with the worry, with the stress, with getting the phone calls in the middle of the night, with trying to do deals with no money, with having, you know, Davy Moyes needing players for the next season, having fans on his back. Believe me, it's not a job he wants to do anymore.
Yeah,
I know that for sure. It's not a job he wants to do. He's not hanging on to that club because he wants it for himself. He wants Everton to be back in the ranks of the great clubs in Europe, you know? Well, I say he wants to be back there. We won the Cup Winners' Cup. We might have won the European Cup next season. Sadly, it was the Heysel season.
Mm.
But that's what he wants. He wants us to be a great club, and he will certainly hand it over to the right person.
And the problem is, what, the ground? Or
well,
why is it not attractive? I mean, City had the new ground, didn't they? Newcastle had a bigger ground, that's attractive.
Well, I think there's two reasons. Right, firstly, the ground, certainly. I think you'd have to spend £300 million to find yourself a new ground, minimum,
yes.
Right? I don't know where they'd put it. Not many people wanted Knowsley.
Yeah.
I think the second problem is actually Merseyside. Merseyside does have, you know, a certain reputation, unfortunately. And the Liverpool people who went in... the American people who went into the Liverpool side of the business, Liverpool FC side of the business, didn't do us any favours because they got there and found they couldn't do things they wanted to do. And they always tried to blame the council. They always tried to blame, you know, they weren't getting cooperation, all that kind of stuff. None of that was true. You know, the council wouldn't do it. The council would help the clubs. But there is a certain stigma about Liverpool, which I don't believe is fair to attach to the city these days, but certainly did many years ago, you know what I mean?
Yes.
And it's still there. And that stigma is all about, would great players go and play for a team in Liverpool? They'll go to Manchester, which doesn't have the same sort of, you know, sort of, I don't know, ethos of being, you know, such a regional identity or something like that. Would they go to Liverpool? I don't know. And that, I think that puts some people off. I think also, you know, excuse me interrupting, is that, you know, when a billionaire comes along and says, I own this club, and he brings his friends over, he does want to take them down the King's Road. He does want to take them to North London and all that kind of stuff, you know.
Maybe not to Norris Green, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. Would you ground share with Liverpool?
I personally would not. I think that a ground...
Because obviously Bill did try to, you know, those plans were floated, weren't they?
Well, I think that you start off with an open mind and you say, suppose we built a stadium called the Merseyside Stadium in the middle of Stanley Park, which is joint ground between the two of us. It was magnificent, looked like the Alliance, and it changed colour. Then you're almost there, you see what I mean?
Yeah.
And it would be a world-famous stadium. You might even get a European Cup final played there or something like that. However, losing your identity if you're in your own club. I mean, we've all been to the San Siro. you know, it's like a dreadfully old. They're knocking it down, aren't they?
Yes,
they're
going
to have two separate ones, and they've gone the other way of having two separate ones. But the worst thing that really got to me was I remember going to Crystal Palace when they were sharing with Wimbledon. Now I know you're not talking about the same scale, you're not talking about the same heritage, but it was Crystal Palace's ground. And there were two little entrances which said Wimbledon FC, and that was it. That was the only identity Wimbledon had in that place. You see what I mean?
Mm.
And you always wonder and worry whether losing your ground means you'd
your own
identity
is going to be. I mean, if he can't sell it, and they can't find investment, how long has Moyes got there before somebody comes for him? Because he's a terrific manager, isn't he?
I'm not a huge fan of David Moyes, but if I went to Everton and saw him, he'd stop. In fact, I had a fantastic... I went up to Scunthorpe last season. We were in the third round, and I love the going to these little grounds where you can still stand up and all that kind of stuff. Fantastic football, like it was as a kid when I was in Chester. And you won't believe it. I went up there and I saw David before the game. Yeah, I was in the bar having a quick sherbet and all that, and he was just walking through. Hi, Dave, how are you doing? And he's a very genial sort of a man. He knows I'm a big Evertonian, you know, and he's always got time for me. Very nice guy. Everybody then disappeared. I thought they'd all gone to the ground. And I had another sherbet, then I went and stood outside the hotel. And then I heard the roar of this sort of rather powerful engine, and then this coach came round from the back of the hotel. I didn't realise that the team had gone and got into the coach at the back, you see. I didn't even know I was in the team hotel and saw Davy Moyes, you know. Anyway, the coach is pulling across the car park on its way to Scunthorpe. It suddenly stops. And you hear this, you know, the switch of the doors, it opens. One of the guys gets off, who I recognise as the kit man, and he says, "Hey, Mike." And I'm looking over my shoulder back into the hotel. I'm wondering who he's talking to. "My gaff says, do you want to lift to the ground?" So anyway, sprinted over the car park, got on the coach. I went to the ground in Everton's team coach, sitting opposite Davy Moyes with Steve Brown next to me and the club doctor there. And as we got to the ground, Davy stood up and said to the guys who were in the back of the coach, "But it is like, it's like an aeroplane, first class here, you know, club class there, you know, and all that." And they came through the arch. He said, "I want you all to shake hands with this boy. He's a great Evertonian and loves you all." I shook hands, everyone just got off. Leighton Baines said, "Hey, Mike, how you doing?" and all that. I remember that when I saw Leighton Baines playing for England just a couple of weeks ago.
So, will he stay, do you think?
Do you know what? I don't know whether Davey has been so loyal to Everton, he might have been there too long already for his own good.
I think he might be right, yeah.
And
He might be waiting for United. Would he get the United job?
Well, Bill Kenwright said recently, Davy Moyes could manage Manchester United, he could manage Barcelona, he could manage AC Milan. And that's the relationship they have between them. Would a chairman take a chance on employing a manager to run Manchester United who had not been able to secure the last 10 years in Champions League football? And inevitably wouldn't have the network of contacts around Europe, which you would need to be tipped off about emerging young players who are vital to the future of the club. I don't know. Davy, to me, is a great, great, great guy. I wouldn't like to make any comment about his professional abilities in Champions League, but I know that there'll be chairmen out there who'll say, we want an Ancelotti. We want a guy who's done it in Europe already.
Well, I would like to see him operate a club with money, and I would like that club to be Everton. Obviously, let's end by one of the things you were most famous for on TalkSport are obviously the great theories that you expounded. Let's go through them one by one. I think the first one we want to talk about is the idea that that referees should, because they need to move around the pitch quickly nowadays.
Yes.
And you propose that they should use Segway scooters to drive
around. That was a bit misinterpreted, really. I mean, you couldn't have one of those on the middle of a pitch because obviously the referee has to move about. They're not that mobile.
Right.
But you can have linesmen on Segways without a shadow of a doubt. And in fact, what I thought was, because I remember being over in California once, you know, they lay down these tracks that they put a camera on, a guy pushes it on
the
ground.
They're like the dolly,
What's wrong with those? Why can't you have those? Because if you had that with a camera on, right, you would then get every single movement of the game without interfering at all, and
the linesman could
be
power
on the top.
It.
Exactly. Linesman on the top. All you do is press that button to go that way, your left foot to go that way, almost, you know, those segues move as you lean on them. A device like that, so you only motion your body to the right and you're going right, body to the left, you're going left. You see what I mean? And that's easy. That's what you do.
That's good. So that's easy. That needs to be brought in.
Yeah.
Obviously, the ones in other sport that people talk about are the Formula One ejector seat.
Yeah, well, you see, that should happen. And in Formula One as well, they've got to change things around. Now that Vettel's won the World Championship, four races to go, dead rubbers. That's what they do in tennis. If it is a dead rubber, they don't play it once you won the Davis Cup. So my view is, you either say to Vettel, push off and let's have a real race so you're not at the front, and then give racing drivers percentage points per race, like you give batsmen in cricket. You see what I mean? So he'd still be up on 9.8 or something like that, you know, or what do you get for a win now? 25 points.
Yes.
He'd be up on 23.8 or something like that, like a world record for, you know, because it'd be divided by the number of races you've actually raced in and the number of first places and all that kind of stuff, you know. So you could do that, take him out. And then the rest could all race around themselves. Jenson Button could win a couple and Lewis Hamilton. Or put Vettel at the back of the grid so that you're then going to watch the fantastic spectacle of Vettel weaving his way through a field of 18 to get to the front.
That makes some kind of sense.
Yeah.
That makes some kind of sense. Now, the wing mirrors for the horses.
Yeah, that's fine.
So jockeys could see behind them.
Yeah. Look, I've been misinterpreted on this as well. I don't mean that you should put wing mirrors on the horse's ears, you know what I mean, like a motorbike. I don't mean that you should have mirrors on the jockey's helmet like you see on a coach, you see what I mean, that go out and come back in. What I mean is, and I got this idea from a spy film, is that when you I'll show you these glasses here, right, these glasses here, you can have a thin, like, little rim of silver there, right? And you can look in it and you can see what's coming past your ears, seriously.
Right.
And this is to help the industry so that jockeys who claim, oh, I'm sorry, I dropped my hands, you know, I thought the horse was 20 yards behind me.
So he could be banged to rights.
Yeah, could be banged to rights in the future. But, I'm not looking for flapping... look, what's wrong with having a flapping wing mirror anyway? To be honest, I mean, you know, they could have them down by the jockey's knees, couldn't they? And then you could see backwards. You know, you could wear them on the jockey's knees, actually. So you're like a motorbike, if you see what I mean. Nothing wrong with that at all. I don't know why I came in for so much ridicule on that and why people still go on about it. I think it was very practical. But if you don't want actual mirrors on the horses, put them in their glasses.
Now, what other ways to improve the game were there? I've got one more before we go.
Yeah.
Is there another one to improve football? Oh, you want the goals increased, don't you? Which I think makes some kind of
that
sense.
That is common sense.
It?
You know, I keep going on. In 1863, when they wrote the rules, the average man was 5'4" tall, okay? And the goal was...
5'4"?
Yeah, 5'4" in 1863. If you don't believe me, go and see HMS Victory near me in Portsmouth, right, which was built in 1800. And the height of the door is such that even I, at 5'8", have to bend down to get through it. Man has, you know, got much, much bigger over the last couple of centuries. Now, we're into the third century of football now, since the rules were written. And I'm telling you that, you know, when you're 5'4" and you reach up, you cannot touch the crossbar. When you're 6'4", which most goalkeepers are these days, and you reach up, you can reach the top of the crossbar and almost look over it. And that's why we've got to change that and make the goals wider. That way we'd get more goals. That way football would be a much more exciting game.
Now, there's that's good. Now, the one that I wanted to talk about, just to wrap up, was you were very taken at one stage by the idea of the coaches' challenge in the NFL.
Yeah.
And but you were worried that they throw a little bag, don't they? They throw a little red bag full of beads onto the pitch. And you were worried that in the hurly-burly of a football game, a soccer game, you wouldn't be able to see the little bag.
Exactly.
So you proposed a system of they had to put on a balaclava.
Yeah, that's right, an orange one.
An orange balaclava.
Yeah. Because what happens is they're walking up and down the side, right? And as soon as you put on the orange balaclava, and it could even have like an orange flashing light on the top, you know, so that everybody could see it. No, come on, fellas, what are you laughing at? This is, you know, all great men have had to go through these sort of things. You know,
they laughed. Yeah, they all laughed at Christopher Columbus when he said the world was round.
Exactly. And as soon as the touchline judge, remember, he's got judges all over the place. He's got observers up there. See, you stop the game and you go on. I don't see any problem with that whatsoever.
Well, the only problem was, as Paul Hawksby pointed out to me last year, he said that if it was Phil Brown, they wouldn't know when he had the orange balaclava on
or not.
Well,
that's true, except for the flashing light on the top. But the flashing light thing should not be unique to that situation. I don't understand why we don't get flashing lights in other sports. For instance, you go skiing, right, as lots of people do in January, all skiers should be made to wear a flashing light on their helmet, otherwise they're running to other skiers. I don't understand why we don't use it more practically in everyday life.
The world has gone crazy, and one man is out to put it to rights, and you can see him on Sports Tonight live television, on Freeview from this weekend, on the internet.
Freeview 121, if you don't mind.
Freeview 121, Mike Parry, the legend. Yeah. It's been a great pleasure.
And may I just say as well, if anybody wants to tweet me, it's at Mike Parry 8, if you don't mind me saying
that. I don't mind that.
And also, you get more of this this nonsense, I was going to say, more of this brilliance on the Two Mikes website.
Excellent. Thank you very much. Back with Robbie Savage and another guest next week. Thanks for listening.
The Daily Mirror calls on you.
Ah, that's absolute bollocks, that. Absolute nonsense.
I am going to get 100% out of you.
we are not just what you call underdogs, but massive underdogs.